Tonight, I'd like to speak about something that, on one hand, is central to not only Buddhist practice, but I believe Indian spirituality in general. That is the term samadhi. I'm willing to guess that it's important in all spiritual traditions, but I won't quite go that far because I try not to impose my Buddhist view on that of other traditions. So I'll offer early Buddhist perspectives on this teaching or term. At the same time, I think it's of vital importance for us who are living in what Bernie Sanders called casino capitalism. I tend to think of it more as cannibal capitalism, but you can call it what you like. I just got a new computer and it came with Windows 10. And so Microsoft is sending me little emails about getting the most out of Windows 10. That's okay, I might read them. The latest one said, multitasking like a pro. To me, that encapsulates one of the reasons why samadhi might be very important today. From what I've read, the neuroscience has unequivocally debunked the whole idea of multitasking. The idea that we could do anything well while multitasking is a major illusion. Yet, I guess, I didn't realize people still believed in it, actually, but that Microsoft is using that in the subject line to get people's attention. I guess a lot of America still wants to multitask like a pro. If you do, this talk isn't for you, because this talk is more about single tasking. This is one way I try to express what samadhi is about. I won't use standard Buddhist translations tonight. Samadhi is the ability to do one thing completely. We could also call it wholeheartedness. To do something where all of our mind, heart, psyche is in it, rather than having multiple windows open and attention bouncing around or the scroll line, you know, the stock markets, the news is going blah, blah, blah up here and the stock market's going on down there. I don't have a TV, but I watch it once in a while at my parents' home. The idea that you can retain any of that is, again, illusion. So the ability to put our attention on something and really care about it, bring our intelligence, our heart to bear, and actually enjoy what we're doing. The multitasking thing, or when our attention is jumping around, scattered, is stressful. I recently was on the highway for 3 hours driving down from Milwaukee, where I gave a talk last night. And you're forced to do a certain amount of multitasking, especially if, like me, you also play the radio and drink some coffee or something. So these habits some of us, including myself, have can be prone to feeding a certain amount of distractedness, inner wobbliness, and stress. My practice, though, is to wean myself of those habits and cultivate what Buddhism calls samadhi. Another term for this is to be simple-minded. Somewhere growing up in the South Chicago suburbs, and this is probably before I went to college, I got the idea that being smart meant having sophisticated, complex ideas. I've come to see that as another obstacle to samadhi. When I was growing up, simple-minded was an insult. And the idea was to be clever, to be able to cut people down with our smart comments. And after college, to have theories that we could rattle off and show how much we know. As I get older, currently pushing 60, simple-minded is of growing interest to me. And partly it's accepting what I'm able to do. The complicated mindfulness doesn't bring me peace or happiness. I don't know, does it bring any of us peace or happiness? So again, I'm advocating samadhi, single tasking, wholeheartedness, simple-mindedness. Yesterday morning, I was back home in Liberation Park, which, by the way, my wife does more of the work than I do, partly because I'm off on the road doing things like this, and she's back home cutting firewood and things like that. I do a fair amount of that, but she's doing even more. But I was home yesterday finishing up a little project, and I had one last thing to do. And to get there, it's a small meditation cabin we've just finished in the back part of our valley. And I have a path through the woods that I like to take. And I was kind of pressed for time because I needed to get in the car to go down to Milwaukee before I got caught in traffic. But as I was going through the woods, it's fall, and we have maples and oaks and birches and quaking aspens and elms and hickories. And there's still some wildflowers as well. And the barberries berries are brilliant scarlet red right now. And there are bluebirds and a few other birds flying around. And so I started out hurrying to do what I wanted to get done. And my jaw just started dropping. There would be an on-fire maple tree, orange, brilliant orange or flaming red. And then there would be this birch that's a beautiful, alive, kind of mellow yellow. And there were still greens. The oaks are darker, some sumacs, which are scarlet red. And we haven't had a hard frost yet, so there's a lot of leaves still on the trees. But something that really gets me is all the different leaves make a carpet. And as I walk through the woods, there's all these different colors. And it's changing, and the views as I go up and down the contours of the land, because there's not much flat in this little valley, and the path is winding, and there are a couple ditches to cross, and trees that have fallen down. And I didn't totally forget where I was going, but increasingly my attention was just on this. Now, this wasn't the kind of samadhi that I was doing anything special. It wasn't something I was creating. It's what my teacher, Ajahn Buddhadasa, would call a gift of nature. That the beauty, and it was a sunny day after some cloudy, overcast weather, and was just so gorgeous. I couldn't help myself that, and I didn't even want to think about it. I just took it in, and I would stop and look around, and then I would walk, but I wasn't walking in a hurry anymore. If I had kept hurrying, I would have caught some of that, but not as much. And I was lucky I had the freedom to walk through the woods. Driving in a car, you see that stuff, but you're right by it in an instant. And if you stop your car in the middle of the highway, you're in trouble. Whereas in the woods, you can stop and look, and for some moments, forget myself and just be alive and experience that. So for what could have been a 5-minute walk became a 15-minute walk, and I dropped the hurry. And again, it wasn't a conscious decision. It was just taking the opportunity that nature was gorgeously presenting. In that, it seems to me there was a nice, we might say, natural samadhi, not the trained samadhi that happens when we're pretty good at meditation, but not yet a master, where we're still working on it. But this is the sort of natural gift that where certain capacities in us respond to something in nature that invites us to be present, to slow down, to have our heart right here and not be scattered in cleverness or reactions or overthinking things. In the early Buddhist teachings that I use as a primary reference, there are passages that speak of mind or heart, psyche, awareness that is clear, calm, stable, bright, alert, agile, un undistracted and unperturbed. Oh, and pure or clean. I want to talk about these descriptors a little bit with the question for everyone present or watching the webcast. To be listening to these qualities of mind and ask yourself, when do these show up in your lives? In what situations, in which activities? Whether it happens like my walk in the woods where it wasn't really intentional, but circumstances came together fortuitously, or when through a practice of meditation, prayer, contemplation, introspection, or in some cases, things like playing music, or doing art, or doing certain kinds of work or craft where we've learned to have single tasking, wholehearted, simple-mindedness. I want to ask this because if samadhi is something of genuine value for us, it seems to me important that we learn to recognize it and then give it more and more opportunity and support, as well as direct training, such as can be done in many forms of meditation. So for the sake of recognizing samadhi, I'd like to go through these descriptors a bit more. In Buddhist terminology, if we describe mind as pure, that means pure because of the absence of egoistic reactivity, the absence of anger, greed, envy, pride, fear, these distorting emotions. That in early Buddhism is understood as what defiles us or tarnishes us, if you like. So purity is absence, or at least a noticeable diminishment of greed, anger, hatred, fear, envy, pride, boredom, excitement, and the like. Stable. Samadhi is stable because it's settled. It's okay with being right here, in this body, in this reality. There's an inner stability. Yet it's bright. It's not stable in a stiff, rigid way. There's an open energy, which is could be understood as buoyant or radiant. And with that brightness, there's a clarity and alertness. It's also described as agile. In certain habits of thinking, we can become very rigid, or the way we hold on to beliefs and opinions. We can have the opinions that, for whatever reason, we've become defensive about. They're non-negotiable. Nobody can question some of my beliefs. And I'm not just talking about conservative fundamentalist types. I still fall into this sometimes. And so there's that rigidity. But with samadhi, that opens up, it loosens up. and there's an agility or nimbleness. If you've seen how our attention can get stuck, samadhi doesn't have that stuckness. This is one reason the traditional translation, concentration, not all Indian traditions translate samadhi that way, but it's common in many forms of Buddhism. But some people understand that concentration in a way that's kind of tight and rigid or forced. So I want to draw attention that the Buddha's reported to have described it as agile, nimble, and imperturbable. Often, little things can provoke us, a word, even somebody's facial expression or tone of voice, and we react very quickly. And if we don't catch it, the reaction can grow. Samadhi has an inner strength that isn't easily provoked, touched off, or perturbed. And although it's one more term, it's not in the list I'm largely quoting from, but a good way to summarize all this is samadhi is to be undistracted. I'm assuming everyone can notice or think of times we've been distracted, where we're trying to do something and we can't focus. It could be external things, our cell phone keeps going off, or the smoke alarm. We have a wood stove, drives the cats crazy. But from the perspective of meditation, and it's not so much those outer things that are distracting us. It's our own lack of samadhi. So again, to run through the list, an inner cleanliness or purity, inner stability, settledness, quiet, calm, even stillness. And I'm not speaking of absolutes. I'm not trying to set a unattainable bar, but just think in terms of what's kind of normal for us, and other times where there's a lot more stillness than is often the case, or a lot more inner purity, inner calm, and yet not calm in a dull, foggy way, but there's a brightness, kind of an inner glow, which has a clarity and aliveness to it. And so inwardly nimble and agile, not easily perturbed and undistracted. I encourage you to think back to times where these qualities have been more or less present. It could be you remember an experience that of great calmness or great clarity. So one of these terms in particular may be what rings a bell. But see if you can kind of examine the memory and see if some of these other qualities were there. And further with this little exercise is by recalling experiences and times of calm, clarity, and undistractedness, this helps us to notice when these occur later today and tomorrow. And if we're living with some sanity, which I admit isn't easy today, there's so much pressure to be crazy. Our society is going off the rails, if you ask me. And so, but I'm assuming everyone who comes to a place like this for an event like this, we're interested in sanity and decency and our own mental and spiritual health, as well as that of society. So if we have that commitment towards sanity, towards peace, towards compassion, then it's not so hard to stop and check in. And if we're living with some sanity, some balance, healthy ethics, we'll find that there are times of relative or even pretty good samadhi. Noticing them, I think, is very important for us and inspiring. I'm saying this because in Buddhist understanding of the spiritual path, samadhi is one of the crucial elements. And the role of samadhi, and notice I haven't translated, I've just talked around it. And I figure at the Theosophical Society, a few old Indian words won't get me fired. And it's one worth learning. What a Buddhist quote that expresses the role of samadhi is, the samadhi mind, the focused, clean, clear, stable, bright, agile, nimble, unperturbed, undistracted mind, knows and sees things as they actually are. In the original language, the word things isn't there. It's just knowing, seeing as actually is. There's no noun in there. So it's the activity of knowing and seeing the unfolding reality of the moment. This is the capacity that samadhi has for all of us. The other reason I suggest noticing this in more or less our regular lives is that the capacity is innate. Things like mindfulness, discipline, kindness, samadhi, native intelligence, we're all born with these. Our kind of ladder climbing hierarchies of knowledge and experthood have done a lot of damage to our self-confidence that the basic spiritual qualities exist in all of us, including samadhi. And noticing relative to pretty good to really good samadhi as we go through our day can help us steer ourselves on the spiritual path. So samadhi with other spiritual qualities enables us to see reality, to understand reality. And I'm not speaking in a theoretical, the understanding is not theoretical. It's more of a direct seeing. And in early Buddhism, this is understood as that which liberates us from greed, hatred, delusion, from suffering and self-centeredness. Now, a key part of samadhi, again, I'm still using the perspectives of early Buddhism, is that samadhi can be hindered by various distracting thoughts, certain moods or attitudes that are basically unhealthy or unwholesome. And so I'd like to briefly review a teaching that lists traditionally five hindering moods, states of mind, or habits of thought that will hinder or interfere with samadhi, which means, oh, I left out one crucial piece of samadhi. It's inwardly content. It's inwardly happy. Samadhi is a kind of joy that doesn't depend on external circumstances, and it doesn't even depend on ideas, beliefs, theories. It's so simple, this kind of joy. So when these hindering thought patterns and moods occur, and they're a fairly regular occurrence, they not only get in the way of our capacity to experience the reality that we're living at this moment, but it also obscures our own capacity to be content, to be happy, to be free. And for this reason, Buddhist meditation teachings talk about abandoning these hindering and distracting thoughts, moods, etc. Let me briefly name examples of these, starting with a traditional list of five. First is, and these are my updated translations, pleasure seeking. That can be in active thought. You're looking through some catalog where to go on holiday. You're fantasizing about this kind of food or that kind of spa or, you know, a gazillion inch flat screen or whatever you think is going to give you pleasure. But also a more moderate version that shows up and which is more noticeable in meditation is, say you're sitting and doing breath meditation, or it could be any form, but that's the main meditation I do. And instead of being fully present to the breath, I find myself kind of looking around for something more fun, more entertaining, something that part of me out of habit believes will give me more pleasure. I never find it, by the way. And I have learned to find a lot of pleasure in the breathing, but a certain habit will still reoccur. So that's one of these hindering habits. A second one is irritability, annoyance, aversion, in a strong form, anger. But in mild forms, you're just a little bit grumpy. You're a little bit, you know, got up on the wrong side of the bed. When you're grumpy, are you happy? Are you content? Are you really present? Or are you finding things to nitpick and criticize? A third hindering habit is dullness. Often people who are subject to this have a passive understanding of it, which actually feeds the dullness. It's not that I'm choosing to be dull. It just happens. That's what I mean by the passivity. No, it's more of a choice. Of course, if you're exhausted, you need sleep, you're sick, there might be some physiological thing going on. But often, we choose to be dull. It can be out of a habit like numbing ourselves. Many of us have been through experiences in life, jobs, families of origin, or parts of the world with political violence. Oh, like America, especially if you're Black or undocumented Latino. We've been subject to all kinds of trauma. And one of the ways to cope is to self-numb. And we've got TV, we've got plugging into our little music boxes. We've got a lot of ways to numb. It's a choice. And one of the consequences of that is a habit of dulling ourselves so we don't feel. A fourth is excitability, restlessness, mind jumping around, overactive, planning, speculating, lots of theorizing, overthinking things. There's often times where we need to do some thinking or planning, but sometimes we just overdo it and can't stop. We worry and so on. So there's a whole range of those, from very busy thinking to more subtle, just kind of restlessness, kind of calm, but unable to really settle down and be quiet. And again, the more subtle form is more apparent, usually in meditation or certain activities like gardening, perhaps painting. I don't paint, but I carve real simple things, spoons. And if I'm not properly focused, I cut myself. So there's some little reminders to stay awake in that one and not be talking and waving my hands about with the knife in it. Very sharp knives, by the way. The fifth in this list is doubt, or a lack of self-confidence. And again, there are a lot of social conditions that are telling most of us we're not smart enough, we're not good enough, we're not whatever enough. And that's a shame, because we've all got plenty to feel a healthy self-confidence about in a way that enables us to take seriously living our lives as wisely, as compassionately as we can. But self-doubt gets in there and, oh, maybe I'm not doing it right, or maybe, you know, I need to be a special kind of person, a monk in Tibet or an enlightened master in Peru, or I don't know, Pope. which, if you know the history, one of the least likely places, even though the current one's not bad. So self-doubt, again, this can be active thinking, or it can be a subtle mood that we don't, deep down, don't trust ourselves, don't trust our own experience. Something happens and we complicate it and can't trust our own inner intelligence. That's the traditional five, and I'd like to add a few others that have come up in conversations with meditation groups here in the Chicago area and up in Wisconsin. Shame. A sense of shame, I'm not sure if it fits well in the traditional five, but I've met a lot of Americans who don't want to talk about it, but inwardly experience a lot of shame, embarrassment, shyness, some call it, about a number of things. It could be a version of the lack of self-confidence I just talked about, but shame is a little more nasty. There's something wrong with me. And some people associate that with guilt, which has a kind of self-punishment aspect. So these are examples of patterns of thought, emotional habits, moods, even attitudes that get in the way of samadhi. I'll conclude by briefly summarizing approaches to responding to these attitudes. Again, within the Buddhist framework, the aim is liberation from egoism, self-centeredness, greed, fear, envy, pride, that kind of stuff. And that requires the capacity to see reality as it is and adjust our way of being so that it's in harmony with reality. And that requires samadhi. So that's the overall picture I'm speaking from. And therefore, recognizing and, to use the traditional language, abandoning or dropping these hindering thought patterns, emotional habits, moods, distractions, and so on, is valuable. In what's nowadays called Vipassana meditation, which is part of the current mindfulness movement, the somewhat Buddhist-oriented part. The advice is usually notice these moods and habits, as I recommended, to do with samadhi. Recognizing when mind is clear, calm, pure, alert, bright, nimble, and undistracted, and then noticing when it's not. And when it's not, noticing the different flavors of distraction or obstruction, such as pleasure-seeking, dullness, or aversion. So one strategy is to just notice. Don't do anything about it, just notice, feel it, because these often have some, we might say, emotional tone or coloring to them, and observe. And the general teaching in this strategy is if we can notice and observe without further reactivity, we gain insight into these and stop feeding them, stop participating. So that's one strategy. It can be very effective, except when a certain pattern is our favorite. My observation is most of us have one or two of these patterns that are so deeply embedded that it's very hard for us to just observe. And we tend to get sucked back in because it's so familiar. We might have a lot of identity hooks. And that can make the just observe strategy difficult. Probably not impossible. So there are other strategies. But if the hindering mood or whatever isn't too strong, just noticing and observing might do the job for now. Another strategy that by coincidence I got emails about in the last week, and which is not my favorite strategy, but I'll mention it, is think your way out of it. And there's a style of spirituality that's quite intellectual, reads a lot of books, kind of philosophical, rational. And though I've got all those interests, I don't actually trust them that much. Sometimes I do. But there's an idea that if you notice it, then you can think your way out of it. My own take on that is perhaps, especially if the pattern is primarily a thought pattern. On the other hand, when we're dealing with the more subtle versions of these, such as occur when we're meditating and things are relatively calm, and we're working at deepening samadhi, so it's more calm and settled. That level, if we start thinking about something like a little bit of dullness or a little bit of restlessness, the thinking is more disturbing than the little bit of dullness or restlessness. So I would say there are circumstances where trying to think our way out of it is inappropriate. And there may be times where it is appropriate. Another strategy which I tend to speak about a lot is that for all these hindering patterns, we can find virtuous qualities that we can cultivate to counteract the unhealthy ones. And there are practices to aid this. For example, a simple meditation practice to, when we sit in meditation, whether on a chair, a cushion, or whatever, we imagine ourselves to be a mountain. And with a little bit of simple creativity, we take on the feel of a mountain, grounded, settled, stable, and yet reaching to the sky. And I've done guided meditations, many teachers do. It can be a simple 5-minute exercise. It can expand longer if we like. The settled stability of that can counteract restlessness. I have a friend in Milwaukee who uses it to counteract his pleasure seeking. He's got a very pleasure seeking mind. And so he uses mountain to settle that. And it might even help with self-doubt, because if you can take on the strength of a mountain, you won't feel that self-doubt as much as you might without that strength. Or there's a practice of traditionally called perception of light. I think of it as invoking a glow. I have the fortune to live in a beautiful little valley that's doesn't have too many bright lights around. And so when there's a moon, we can really see the moonlight. And when there's no moon, we can see the starlight, except if it's cloudy, of course. And one can give a lot of attention to the moonlight or the starlight until one kind of sees it with the eyes closed. With some practice, one can evoke that glow almost at will, at least fairly easily. And there are similar virtuous qualities. Generosity can help counteract pleasure seeking. Forgiveness and appreciation can counteract annoyance and irritability. Simplicity counteracts busy-mindedness as well as pleasure-seeking, because in our consumer culture, pleasure-seeking also can involve accumulating lots of stuff. So simplifying, like our closets or garages, can help counteract those tendencies. So this is a third strategy, that through lifestyle and through specific practices, we cultivate qualities that counteract these hindering obstructions. And specifically, if you notice you have one or two favorites, then you might want to focus on virtues that will counteract your favorite unhealthy patterns. And that may take a number of years for the virtue. If you're a real stingy, kind of critical, bitter person, it might take a while to cultivate the generosity and appreciation for others, but it's worth it. A fourth strategy, which I'll end with, we might call the ultimate strategy, is to see all of these hindering patterns as empty of me and mine. The usual way we interpret life is there's me and you, there's us and them, there's those people, which means there's me or us. And so we, to a large extent, are trapped in ourselves. And then these hindering moods and distracting thoughts, it's very easy to assume it's me. If we look deeply into them, it's possible to begin to realize none of this is me or mine. It's just passing stuff, patterns that we've gotten hooked in. And by deeply inquiring, we can drop the belief that it's me or mine, which applies to samadhi as well. If I'm trying to get concentrated, or if I'm trying to focus, that's the ultimate obstacle. And when we drop the me who's trying, the I that thinks it's doing this, things get real easy. So these are some thoughts on samadhi. I hope you find them useful for your own reflection and to support your own path and whatever practices and exercises you do to cultivate the path.
Thank you for your speech. It was very thorough and deep. My question is that some of the things which distract being in samadhi, is mainly not accepting the way it is, and we have rationale for getting distracted because it's not me. The outside is distracting me, and that's the trap, and make a good story about it and get lost in it.
Right.
The conditioning, the conditioning we are carrying with us, that also has a significant impact on easily getting irritated or distracted, losing focus on, and especially the kind of culture we are in, it encourages multitasking in every way, and it's a habitual distraction.
Right.
So all these, your techniques will help. This conditioning part, I don't know how to go about. That's so deep-rooted. I don't know.
Right.
Thank you.
Well, that's one of the little tricks in, if we start to notice we're distracted somehow, yes, it's real easy to blame it on something outside. Or then if you're critical of certain social things, then you can get in your head going, oh, it's because of this and that, the government, Microsoft. But the practice of a meditator is to learn to stop seeking answers out there and shift attention inside. So by inquiring, there's distraction. What's the flavor of the distraction? You don't have to know immediately, but just by inquiring, you shift attention from looking outward to place blame or to make excuses, and you shift it inward. And it's sometimes like when I'm going about my day, I'll just go through the list. Is this pleasure seeking? Is this irritability? Is it dullness? Is it restlessness or monkey mind or planning? Is this doubt? Is it envy? And now I'm looking inside. And if I inquire in a calm, simple way, that already is freeing from the distraction. And that's part of building a practice around this.
One of the techniques I use is to, maybe it falls into guilt or whatever, it's to, if an anxiety or a thought that's negative, I try to push it away, meaning I don't want to deal with it. I don't know if that's a good or bad technique, but when it comes and it gives me anxiety, I don't want to deal with it, so I want to push it away.
Yeah.
And yeah. I mean, how do you feel about that? What's your comment on that? And this is a good long-term strategy.
No.
<Thank you.
laughs> Sorry. If you look into that, wanting to push something away is often a form of anger. You don't like it. That's called aversion. Sometimes it can have more of a fear quality. You're kind of, this is going to hurt me or cause me trouble or discomfort. But trying to push away is another distracting and limiting pattern. So what I'm gonna say is subtly different. If our intention is to push something away, we're bringing some degree of angry or fearful energy to it. But when you want to push something away, it's still got your attention. So you're still kind of in a dance with it, and not such a pleasant dance. It'll often make us tense. But what one can do is, if you use the idea of the third strategy, you can shift your attention to something wholesome and pleasant. Like an easy one I do at our place, we have a bunch of cats. Our barn, we have two cats, and they're funny. And we do stuff, and they follow us around, and they're entertaining. So I just think of the cats, and they make me smile. I don't have to get rid of that unpleasant thing. All I have to do is think of the cat. And my mind can't hold both. So that's one technique that's, I think, healthier. The first strategy I mentioned is, if there's something you want to push away because it's uncomfortable, painful, I think you said causes anxiety. If you're pushing away, it's still got your attention. The first strategy I mentioned, by observing, instead of being fixed on the anxiety itself, you can shift to how you're feeling inside and kind of just notice how the anxiety feels, not what you're anxious about, but the quality of the anxiety itself. And if you have the courage and the trust to just sit with that for a little bit, you're unhooking from what provoked it. And that can give it a chance to subside on its own. So if the anxiety is provoked by a certain memory or thought or external circumstances, you can unhook by feeling the anxiety itself. That's not always popular, because anxiety doesn't feel good. So we have all kinds of medications. In Wisconsin, there's one on every corner. We call them bars.
You mentioned your experience in the woods in a beautiful scene of nature, and how it, your experience of feeling a kind of union with the beauty of the surroundings, and maybe a lessening of ego in response to what you experienced. And I'm wondering, how too could we have that kind of experience in the things that we perceive as neutral or mundane, or how do we kind of incorporate that into daily life?
Yeah, that's, I think, a very valuable question, because, yeah, we can't always depend on beautiful nature to help us be present. So I brought that example up to sort of help us inquire the kind of thing like you're asking. Part of my training in Buddhism involves learning to do everyday tasks, washing the dishes, brushing teeth, making lunch, to do them as single tasking. And simply doing one thing at a time can have its own liveliness and presence and joy. So in a way it's neutral, but actually it's enhanced by just doing the little mundane task that you need to do rather than thinking about the bigger one. That's, you know, you've got some meeting or a report or whatever. And so you're not actually just doing stuff like brushing your teeth. Sounds real simple, but the example of the woods was kind of cheating because nature did a lot of the work. But through practice, when there's pretty good samadhi, it in itself has an internal light and joy. And that can be supported also by bringing us perspectives such as service. This was part of my teacher's message. He taught meditation, but he also taught a lot about practicing Buddhist teachings in daily life and for everybody, not just monks living in the forest. And a key part of that were notions of duty, responsibility, and service. So at his monastery, part of our training was to serve, that everybody had things to do to contribute to both the monastery, people coming, as well as society. And one of the traps of being paid for the work we do is we can be seduced into thinking we're doing it for the money, which means we lose the opportunity to do it as service, or at least to let that animate it. But if we really think through things we do in life, even feeding ourselves properly, taking care of our own health, our own home, there are ways to see that as service. Taking care of my health makes my wife's life easier, for example, and less chance of me breaking down and costing society a lot of money. But if we look deeply into all the things we do and highlight the aspect of service. And in Buddhism, it's not a problem that, sure, it benefits me, keeps me healthy, keeps me alive, keeps a roof over my head, that's fine. But also be doing it to serve others, serve society, serve Dhamma, serve God, truth, whatever our reference is. And if that's alive in us, that will help quite a bit.
8 years ago, something happened to me, that something physical. And I'm homebound about 22 out of 24 hours a day. And mostly I live that time in silence, no TV, no music, no radio. I haven't actually made a decision not to do those things. It just came to pass. And I would say that initially, I fell into this way of life, kicking and screaming. But now I'm at peace with it most of the time. But I really have trouble with January and February. I am an outdoor person, and I always have the windows open, you know, whenever I can. Even in the winter, if the temperature gets up into the 40s, I have the front door open. The storm on the door is still down, but just to feel that connection. Mm-hmm. But January and February, can really get to me. Do you have any suggestions for how to deal with that?
Yeah, a lot of ginger tea with honey, vitamin D3. I'm serious. Grow lights and flowers. You know, grow flowers that you can. Get some grow lights to aid that. Brighten up the house, things like that. And then, because there is the physiological thing of winter, and then as much exercise as you're able to, whether in a chair or standing, walking. And then find practices that increase the inner glow that I referred to a few times. In Buddhism, there are practices like loving kindness that are can be quite simple, quite beautiful. And to do them as a practice, but also as something joyful, where loving kindness, there are a lot of different ways, but often it's just repeating a phrase like, may all beings be well. And then one can do variations on that. Just repeat the same phrase. May all beings be well. May we all be well. May all beings be happy, healthy, free. And it's basically just wishing well to everyone, including ourselves. And for many of us, not limiting it to human beings, but all living things. Something like that, if we relax into it and begin to enjoy it, it brightens things up inside. So there are some externals we can do, and then inner practices. And it could be the lifestyle you describe sounds pretty quiet. So maybe in winter we need something a little more stimulating at times. If you can do it all on your own, great. But if sometimes you need a little help, might be okay. Like, I don't know, I like watching musicals like The Sound of Music sometimes. Just the good old kind of inspiring, lively, happy movies.
I used to know every one of those songs by heart.
Well, then sing, yeah. Sing, get out a ukulele or something. There's a Buddhist term that's translated skillful means. At times we're able to function on, we might say, a high level, and so the practice is more refined. At other times it's a struggle, and so we use whatever means we're capable of at that time. And it's unfair to us to always expect that we function on a real high spiritual level. And so to be willing to do something like watch a movie, if that's what you've